The science delusion is the belief that science already understands the nature of reality in principle, leaving only the details to be filled in. This is very widely believed by people in our society. In fact, it's the universal default worldview of educated people. And science is, of course, extremely prestigious because it works so well. All of us depend on science and technology every day of our lives, through the technologies in which we live and also through modern medicine. But there's now a conflict between science as a worldview and science as a method of inquiry. The scientific method is inquiring through hypothesis and experimental evidence and critical discussion. And it's a liberating way of inquiring into nature. That's why science is a progressive system of discovery. But science has also become a worldview, a way of seeing the world, which has become increasingly dogmatic. Since the 19th century, the so-called scientific worldview has been dominated by the philosophy of materialism, the doctrine that the only reality is matter or physical reality. And this has now become a restrictive framework for scientific inquiry, increasingly constricting what questions can be asked and what research can be done. In think tanks in London and in Washington and elsewhere in the world, policymakers are now very concerned with a problem that they call the innovation deficit. Their argument is that the West can only compete with the rising Eastern economies by being more innovative. But in science and technology, we're not being very innovative. There have been almost no breakthroughs in the last 20 or 30 years. There's been incremental improvement, gradual improvement, but our present research system is not friendly towards radical change. It's extremely conservative. And this has led to this innovation deficit. This is now a matter of serious concern to politicians and policymakers. Part of the reason for it is the institutional framework of science, which deters originality and heresy. But part of it is the restrictive framework of thought that the philosophy of materialism has imposed on the sciences. In my book,
you don't need to hold the microphone.
What? I don't need to hold it. Okay. In my book, The Science Delusion, what I do is take the 10 basic dogmas of materialism and turn them into questions. And I examine these dogmas not as if they're truths, but as if they're hypotheses that can be tested scientifically. And I ask, what is the evidence? Usually, these dogmas are simply taken for granted. People think that they're simply the truth. Most materialists don't realize that their belief system is a belief system. They think other people have belief systems, but they know the truth. And so what I'm doing is taking these 10 dogmas and looking at them scientifically. This is a purely scientific exercise. So first I'm going to summarize the 10 dogmas. Then I shall look at two or three of them this morning, and this afternoon I'll look at some more of them. The first dogma is that nature is mechanical, machine-like. The only valid metaphor for looking at nature is the machine. The universe is a machine, animals are machines, plants are machines, we are machines. According to Richard Dawkins, we are lumbering robots. We're simply machines, and our brains are nothing but genetically programmed computers. The second dogma is that matter is unconscious. The whole universe is made of matter, and matter's unconscious. The stars, the planets, the entire universe has come into being completely without consciousness. And then on this Earth, at some stage in the past, for reasons utterly unknown, the light bulb of consciousness was switched on in human brains, maybe in animal brains, but the rest of the universe is totally unconscious. The third dogma is that the laws of nature are fixed. All the laws of nature were established at the moment of the Big Bang exactly as they are today, and they're rather like a kind of cosmic Napoleonic code that was fixed right from the outset and will remain the same forever. The fourth dogma is that the total amount of matter and energy is always the same. This is the principle of conservation of matter and energy. All of us learned it at school. The total amount of matter and energy is always the same, except at the moment of the Big Bang, when all the matter and energy suddenly appeared. As my friend Terence McKenna used to say, modern science is based on the principle, give us one free miracle and we'll explain the rest. And the one free miracle is the appearance of all the matter and energy in the universe and all the laws that govern it from nothing in a single instant. The fifth dogma is that nature is purposeless. There are no purposes in nature. Animals and plants are not teleological. They're just come about by chance mutations. And evolution has no purpose or direction. The entire universe is blindly going nowhere. The sixth dogma is that biological inheritance is material. Everything you inherit biologically is inherited in chemical genes, DNA, in epigenetic modifications of the genes, chemical changes associated with the genes, or in cytoplasmic inheritance, but it's all material. Dogma seven is that memories are stored materially inside your brains. Everything we can remember is inside our head. No one knows how it works, but it's assumed that it must be because of phosphorylated proteins, modified nerve endings, or some other material changes in the brain. Dogma eight is that your mind is nothing but the activity of your brain. Your mind is inside your head. The mind is entirely confined to the inside of the skull. Dogma nine is a consequence of Dogma 8. It says that psychic phenomena, like telepathy, are illusory. They may appear to happen, but they can't really happen because they're impossible. Your mind is totally confined to the inside of your head, so it can't possibly have any effects at a distance. So even though there may be some evidence for telepathy, we know in advance that that evidence must be either flawed or fraudulent because it's simply impossible. And dogma 10 is that mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works. Complementary and alternative medicines may appear to work, but that's just because people would have got better anyway, or it's nothing but the placebo effect. The only kind that really works is medicine that works on the machinery of the body. The body is a physico-chemical machine, so the only kind of medicine that can really work is physical or chemical, surgery or drugs. And of course, surgery and drugs do work for many conditions, but there are many other forms of therapy that indeed do seem to work as well. But because the dogma that mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works, it means that most government health funding and most research funding for medicine, in some countries almost all of it, is devoted only to mechanistic medicine, and all other forms of therapy are ignored. They're not ignored by ordinary people, of course. There are millions, hundreds of millions of people who go to alternative therapists of one kind or another, but they're ignored by the official worldview. Now, these 10 dogmas constitute the default worldview, which is the standard orthodoxy of politics, business, government, and education. All of us have been brought up within that framework of thought. Of course, not all scientists are totally convinced by this. In every area of science, there are dissidents, radicals, heretics, who are questioning these dogmas. But this basic materialist worldview is still the default standard worldview against the background of which any deviation is treated as heresy. But science itself has now undermined, indeed overthrown, every one of these dogmas. Not one of them stands up to serious scientific scrutiny. And what I'm going to do today, I haven't time to talk about all 10 of them, but I'm going to start with nature being mechanical. This is familiar, so I shall do it briefly, and then I'll go on to the dogma that matters unconscious, and I'll speak more about consciousness this morning. The dogma that nature is mechanical was the foundational step that gave rise to modern science. In the 17th century, the scientific revolution was a revolution because it overthrew the older view of nature, which was taught in all the European universities and monasteries in the Middle Ages. The medieval view of nature, based on Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, was that nature is organic. The universe is a living universe. The earth is Mother Earth. Animals and plants are truly alive. Plants have souls. The soul of the plant gives form or shape to the plant. It's the form of the body. And what Aristotle and St. Thomas called the vegetative soul is what shapes each plant species. The oak tree has a soul that gives form or shape to the tree. The seedling, the acorn, germinates and gives a seedling, and this seedling is attracted towards the mature form of the oak by the soul of the oak. Animals also have vegetative souls that shape the body, and in addition, they have animal souls that give rise to the instincts, coordinate sensations and movements. And of course, the English word animal comes from the Latin word anima, which means soul. Humans, on this medieval view, have a vegetative soul that shapes the body, an animal soul that gives us our animal nature, largely unconscious, but in addition, the rational or intellectual soul, which underlies rational thought, reason, language, mathematics, and so on. This was the medieval view, and this was exactly the view that the scientific revolution overthrew. It abolished the idea of souls in nature. Nature was made up not of organisms, which have their own purposes and are self-organizing. Instead, nature was made of machines. Machines are like organisms in that they have parts that work together. But unlike organisms, they don't organize themselves. They don't form themselves. That's why we need factories to make them. And they don't design themselves. They need engineers and designers to design them. In the 17th century, the founding fathers of modern science were devout Christians, and they thought that by creating a mechanistic theory of nature, they could create a new kind of theology, which they did create, mechanistic theology, where God was conceived of as a machine maker, an engineer, and a mathematician. So all the designs of animals and plants were not designed by nature. They were not designed by the animals and plants themselves. The purposes were not inherent in nature, as they were before. Instead, all designs, purposes, ideas were in God. So they thought they were increasing the importance and role of God and diminishing the importance of nature. So this led to a mechanical worldview. It also meant that nature had no purposes of its own. That's why in 19th century evolutionary thought, evolution has no purpose. The universe is a machine. A machine has no purpose of its own. You can see the difference if you think of a car. You get into a car, and if as long as the car is working, it will go wherever you want it to go. It doesn't have any desire or purpose of its own. If you get onto a horse, it might be a very different story. The horse might easily have ideas of its own about what it wants to do. That's because it's an organism, not a machine. So this idea that nature is a machine is stripped out purpose from nature. Dogma 5, nature is purposeless, is nothing but a consequence of dogma 1, nature is mechanical. It's simply part of the metaphor. But this is not a testable scientific theory. It's only a metaphor. It's not something you can prove with too many places of decimals by precise experiments. It's simply a way of thinking. And there's no reason whatever that we have to adopt only one metaphor, one size fits all, for the whole universe and everything within it. I think that what we can easily do is adopt the radical point of view that living organisms are organisms, that the universe is an organism. In fact, the universe as it's now conceived, starting with the Big Bang, which is rather like the hatching of the cosmic egg, and then growing and cooling and expanding, and as it grows and cools, the structure within the universe increases. This is much more like a developing organism than like a machine. Well, one consequence of this way of thinking is that matter's unconscious, and this is the second dogma, which I'm now coming on to. This was simply a definition in the 17th century by a Frenchman, René Descartes. And Descartes separated matter and mind. He got rid of soul from nature, and that left only rational minds and inanimate matter. And so he created the famous Cartesian dualism. Matter was defined as unconscious. He didn't prove it by experiment. He simply assumed that all matter is unconscious and mechanical, including human bodies. Then minds are something completely different. They're not in space, they're not in time, they're immaterial, they're eternal. And minds are confined to human beings, the spirit of human beings, angels, and God. So this creates an extreme dualism in humans between mind and body. The mind is immaterial, the body is material, and the two interact, according to Descartes, in a small region of the brain, the pineal gland. Modern theories of dualism are similar, except the supposed seat of interaction has moved 3 or 4 centimeters into the cerebral cortex. But this conception of the body as completely mechanical is the basis of modern medicine, as I said. There's also a duality between humans and animals. Animals don't have rational minds, they're just machines. That's why it's all right to vivisect animals. Descartes himself practiced vivisection on dogs, because they're just machines. They can't feel pain, they can't think, they don't have emotions, they're just machines. And that's the basis of modern industrial agriculture and factory farming. Animals are just machines. Our whole modern economy is based on this assumption. It also creates a separation between religion and science, and God and nature, because religion in this division got human morality, human souls, angels, and God. Science got the whole of the universe, all of nature, and the human body. And by separating these realms, for most of the history of science, religion and science were kept separate. People could be devout Christians or Jews and practicing mechanistic scientists without any conflict, because they were kept in separate compartments. But by the 19th century, many people came to dislike this extreme dualism. Most people don't like dualisms, and so the question was what to do about it. Well, one way of dealing with a dualism is to say that two is too few, and we need to move to an understanding that has at least three aspects to it, a Trinitarian understanding. That, I think, is the best way of going, that ultimate reality has a triple or threefold, at least a threefold nature. But most people in the 19th century thought that two was too many and that we should go down to one basic principle. And there were two ways of dealing with Cartesian dualism. One was to say, matter doesn't exist, the only thing that exists is spirit or mind, and that's the philosophy of idealism. Spirit is the only reality. Consciousness is the only reality. Matter is kind of dumbed down mind. But most people in the 19th century went the other way. The dominant ethos of 19th century intellectuals shifted to materialism. Spirit doesn't exist, matter's the only reality. One reason that they took this step was not because of scientific data, it was because many intellectuals were alienated from the Christian tradition. The Enlightenment in France and elsewhere in Europe was profoundly anti-Christian, and it was associated with anti-clericalism and the growth of atheism. Communism, early socialism were essentially atheistic. And for the reasons of polemics against the church and the liberation of secular society from religious control, materialism was a very attractive dogma. It gave all the prestige of science to this new view. It enabled propagandists to say science represents the future and progress, religion holds people back, it's superstition, people are dominated by priests and so on. So for various reasons to do with anti-religious polemic, materialism became the preferred philosophy of many intellectuals. And it gave an enormous authority to science, which now became like the new religion and scientists the new priests. Anyway, for a variety of, this is a complex social pattern that went on in the 19th century, but by the end of the 19th century, the default worldview was materialism. Matter's the only reality. At one stroke, the whole world of spirit is removed. Angels and God are abolished immediately. So you get instant atheism. And you then have the idea that the human mind is nothing but the activity of the brain. That, of course, is a problem. Because according to the materialist doctrine, matter's the only reality and matter's unconscious. Yet human beings are conscious. It's hardly possible to not deny that we are conscious. And yet we ought not to be. This is the most fundamental problem for materialism. In the 20th century, in the English-speaking world, the majority of psychologists in universities belonged to the behaviorist school, which said that the only valid scientific objective reality is measurable behavior, the movements of muscles and the secretions of glands. And that consciousness is nothing but an illusory concept designed to confuse people, that it's subjective, it's therefore it doesn't exist, objective reality is the only thing that's scientific, and therefore psychology should proceed with no reference to consciousness. In the British Psychological Society, about 15 years ago, a radical branch set up a minority group within the Psychological Society called the Consciousness Studies Research Group. And this was considered heretical and radical at the time that psychologists should discuss consciousness. So philosophers of mind in the English-speaking world were and still are mainly materialists. So their job is to prove that the mind is nothing but the brain and that consciousness is an illusion. I went to a debate only 3 weeks ago in London between Daniel Dennett, a leading materialist philosopher, and Nicholas Humphrey, a leading materialist psychologist, about the nature of the mind. Dennett said, the mind is a pure illusion. There's nothing but nervous activity all the way through the brain. And so then, of course, the question is, how do you explain the fact we're conscious? Well, it's just an illusion. Humphrey put forward a different theory. He said it's not just an illusion, it's the appearance of an illusion. And so they argued for the whole of this debate about whether it was an illusion or the appearance of an illusion. But of course, neither of this really answers the question because illusion is itself a mode of consciousness. It presupposes rather than explains consciousness. Now, it's amazing that grown men, for generations, could spend their time trying to disprove the fact that they themselves are conscious, or that they have free choice, because they, after all, try to persuade you of materialism on the basis of science, reason, and evidence. But actually, the only way you can be a materialist from a materialist point of view is because your brain makes you do it, and you don't really have any choice in the matter. So there's all these inconsistencies. They've become intolerable to some philosophers, and in the English-speaking world, there's now a movement against materialism, or at least going beyond it. Galen Strawson is one of our leading British philosophers, and he came out a few years ago by saying that the only way consciousness could be explained is by assuming that matter, even at the electron or atomic level, has some kind of mental activity. In other words, he's adopting a form of panpsychism, the doctrine that there's a kind of psyche or mind throughout the material world, not just in human brains or animal brains. A few months ago, Thomas Nagel, one of the leading American philosophers of mind, wrote a book called Mind and Cosmos, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. This book caused a tremendous stir in intellectual circles in America and in Britain, and was denounced as heresy by some of the leading materialists. But Nagel, like Strawson, is now advocating a form of panpsychism. Of course, panpsychism is not a new philosophy. It's what most people believed in the Middle Ages. And in the 17th century, after Descartes put forward his extreme dualism, two major philosophers in Europe came out with panpsychist views. One was Leibniz. And Leibniz argued that every self-organizing unit, or monad, has both a body and a mind, and each monad reflects the universe from its own point of view. Just like in this room, each one of us is in a different place. We're each seeing this room from our own point of view. None of us is seeing it from the same point of view as anyone else, because by definition, we're in different places, being in bodies which can't occupy the same place at the same time. And he argued that monads, including non-biological monads throughout all nature, reflect the whole universe from their own point of view. Spinoza took the view that nature, the material world, is the body of God. God is the mind of nature, and that nature and God are the body and mind of an intrinsic fundamental unity. In the 20th century, the most interesting panpsychist philosopher, in my opinion, was Alfred North Whitehead, a British philosopher. Whitehead was a mathematician as well as a philosopher, and he was the first philosopher to appreciate the significance of quantum theory in the 1920s. Whitehead realized that quantum theory meant that matter could no longer be seen as just stuff, solid stuff like little billiard balls. Matter was wave-like. Matter meant that all material objects are processes, not things. And processes take time. A wave takes time to wave. You can't have an instantaneous wave because it takes time for its wave nature to be expressed. And it can't be confined to a single point because waves are spread out in space. This is ultimately the reason for the uncertainty principle in quantum physics, that waves are spread out in space and time. Even an electron is spread out in time. Whitehead pointed out that this means that in all bodies, in all material systems, including electrons, there's a polarity in time between past and future, that there's a polarity in all processes. There has to be. And he took a very interesting approach to the question of the relation of mind and body. All of us are familiar with the conventional way of thinking about the relation of mind and body that uses a spatial metaphor. The mind is inside, the body's outside. We have our inner life, and that's the outer world. We're used to this kind of spatial metaphor, inner and outer. But Whitehead thought a much better way of thinking about it was in terms of time. That every process in time has a polarity between past and future. And the future pole is the mental pole, the past pole is the physical pole. If you think of an electron, the future of an electron as it's moving is given by the Schrödinger wave equation. It's an equation which tells you all the possible things that electron could do. None of them are physically real yet because they haven't happened. They're just possibilities or probabilities. which don't have a physical reality, but they exist in some other realm, a realm of possibility. As soon as the electron interacts with something, one of those possibilities comes true, and the others disappear. Sometimes this is called the collapse of the wave function. As soon as it's happened, it's in the past. It's a physical fact, it's observable, but it's in the past. And immediately a new wave of possibilities opens up, which is, the, as it were, the mental pole of the electron. In a similar way, in our own being, our minds, our conscious minds, are concerned with possibilities. Many of the things that happen in our minds are going through different possible actions, and our minds help us choose between them. The possibilities are to do with future actions, future possibilities. They're not measurable physically because they're possibilities. They don't have a physical, observable, objective existence. Possibilities are of a different order of thing. But as soon as we make a decision and do something, that becomes an observable fact, and it's immediately in the past. For example, every one of us is in this room today because we decided to come here. We could have done many other things this morning. All of us had alternative possibilities. But when we decided to come here, out of the many possibilities, we decided on this particular possibility, and when we put it into action and arrive here, it's an observable fact that we're in this room. We can be photographed, we can be weighed, measured. It's a physical fact. But when it was at the realm of possibility, it was about a choice among virtual futures, which weren't physical facts. So this polarity of past and future, I think, is particularly interesting as a way of thinking of the relation of body and mind. It implies a two-way flow of causation. Physical causation moves from the past to the present. It pushes from the past. Mental causation pulls from the future. And these two overlap in the present. One is pulling towards the future, the other is pushing from the past. Another way you can think of it is the causal influence of the mind works backwards from future towards the past. Physical causation works from past towards the future. So this, I think, provides us with a new way of thinking about the relation of mind and body. And it goes beyond the problem that regular materialist philosophy has of the nature of consciousness, which is usually called the hard problem, because it simply can't be solved by materialism. But if we have a more panpsychist approach, then it's not really materialism anymore. Some panpsychists today call themselves materialists, but it goes way beyond old-style materialism. Most of the debate about panpsychism focuses on electrons and on atoms. Now, it's a bit hard for us to imagine the consciousness of an electron or an atom, and indeed it may not be conscious. It may be mental without being conscious for most of the time. Most of our own mental activity is unconscious. We don't need to assume that all mental activity is conscious. 95% of our own is not. It's unconscious, but it's still mental. And so there's a question as to how much consciousness would actually be present in an atom. But the whole of this discussion becomes more interesting when we think about big things instead of little things. There are many self-organizing systems in nature, and some of them are very obvious, like the sun. The sun organizes itself. It coordinates the entire solar system. The solar system is, in a sense, its body. It's included within the solar wind, the solar electromagnetic field, and all around the edge of the solar system is something called the heliopores, like a kind of membrane that separates off the entire solar system from the rest of the galaxy. This, in a sense, is the body of the solar system. Now, if material bodies that are self-organizing can have minds or consciousness, what about the sun? Could the sun be conscious? Well, personally, I think it probably is. And if the sun's conscious, what about the other stars? Well, why not? And if the stars are conscious, what about the entire galaxy, which is a huge organism containing many stars, which are like the cells in the body of the galaxy? Could there be a galactic mind? I think there probably is. And again, why not? But all of you realize that as soon as you ask the question, can the sun think? Is the sun conscious? This question is not allowed by the materialist philosophy. It's completely taboo. The fact is that most people in most cultures think the sun is conscious. In India, Surya, the sun god, is conscious. Gayatri is the subject of the Gayatri mantra, a fundamental mantra of Hinduism, where the sun is asked to illuminate our meditation, this great mind of the sun. In Japan, the sun is a goddess. In many parts of the world, the sun is an animate being, a god or a goddess, or a living being. For children, in our culture, the sun is alive. When they draw the sun, they have a smiley face on it. But precisely because almost all of humanity has thought the sun's alive and conscious, and that children think so, this is the exact reason why materialists feel that they're smarter and cleverer than everyone else in saying it's not conscious. It's childish, superstitious, primitive, and stupid to think that the sun's conscious, whereas people used to think the sun is conscious, but we now know it's nothing but a giant hydrogen bomb. Now, that's the common attitude of the materialism. We've risen above these other ways of thinking. But there's no evidence for that at all. It's simply an assumption that follows from the machine doctrine of nature. So I think we can entertain the idea that the sun is conscious. I think it's a completely open question. And if the sun and the stars and the galaxies are conscious, we can regain a sense that the whole universe is alive, not just alive, but has a conscious life. Now, of course, we don't know what the sun thinks about. I imagine that if it thinks, it probably thinks a lot about its body, the solar system, and of course it can modulate the solar system through solar flares, coronal mass ejections. It's constantly affecting the whole solar system. It probably also thinks about its peer group, the other stars. So these things, I think, are possible. Now, I can't prove that the sun is conscious, but you can't prove that it's not conscious. It's, I think, an open question. But it's not permissible within dogmatic materialism. If we raise the... As soon as we question the doctrine that matter's unconscious, we arrive at first at panpsychism, then that extends to considering large as well as small material objects, including stars and galaxies. I want to turn now to the dogma that the mind is nothing but the activity of the brain. It's all inside the head. The mind is supposed to be nothing but the activity of the brain because mental activity is just a product of nervous activity. That means that all of your mind is inside your head. Now, for dualists, the mind is completely separable from the brain. Old-style dualism sees the mind working on and interacting with the brain, but being completely separate in nature. And we've had this dialogue in the West for the last 300 years, dualism versus materialism. But I think there's a way forward which is neither of those familiar positions. I think our minds are extended in space through fields. We're familiar with fields from magnets. Magnets have fields within them and around them, magnetic fields. The magnetic field is a region of influence around the magnet that can affect other magnetic objects some way away from the magnet. The Earth has a magnetic field. The Earth also has a gravitational field. It's inside the Earth, and it stretches far beyond it. It keeps the Moon in its orbit. Your mobile telephone has a magnetic field, an electromagnetic field. It's inside the telephone, and it stretches invisibly beyond it, which is why the telephone works. And I think our minds are based on fields that are in our brains, at least most of the time, but also stretch out beyond them. So I think our minds are much more extensive than our brains or than our bodies. They stretch out far beyond them. The easiest way to understand this is by thinking about the nature of vision. What happens when you see something? Surprisingly, no one really knows. This is now a very active topic of debate within the field of consciousness studies. But you all know the familiar conventional answer. When you see me standing here now, what happens is light is reflected from me, it goes through the electromagnetic field, enters your eyes, inverted images on your retinas, changes in the cone cells, impulses up the optic nerves, and changes in various regions of the brain. That's familiar, and we know more detail than we ever did before, because the details of changes in the brain have been worked out through brain scanning in more detail than ever before. But does it explain vision? No, it simply describes what happens inside the brain. The first problem is that you're conscious of what you see. There's no explanation for that in neuroscience or in materialist physiology. None at all. That's another example of the hard problem. The fact you're conscious has no explanation. But the point that I'm more interested in here is the question of where your vision is occurring. It's all inside your brain. That's what the theory says. That means that right now, as you see me, there must be a little Rupert somewhere inside your head, and the rest of this room is somehow inside your head. Your experience of a three-dimensional coloured world is all inside your head. This debate has been thrown into sharp relief by a recent paper in the Journal of Consciousness Studies that was called "Is Your Skull Beyond the Sky?" The author of the paper, who's a materialist philosopher, said, everything you see is inside your brain. Your brain produces a mysterious virtual reality display of everything you're experiencing. When you look at the sky, your image of the sky is inside your head. Your skull is therefore beyond the sky. This is only a virtual skull produced as part of your virtual reality display. Your real skull is outside all your experience. This is the official view, radical though it is, and absurd though it seems when you think it through. But there's an alternative, and the alternative is much simpler. In fact, it's so simple it's hard to understand. That is that your image of me is inside your mind, but it's not inside your brain. It's here, exactly where it seems to be. That everything you're looking at, the images, are outside your brain where they seem to be, in a spatially extended world. What I'm suggesting is vision involves a two-way process. Light comes in, changes happen in the brain, and the images are projected out to where they seem to be. Sometimes they're projected to where they're not, where things aren't. And that's an illusion or a hallucination or a mirror image. When you look at something in a mirror, your projections are not bent by the glass because they're not made of light. They're not physical in that same sense. They go straight through it, producing virtual images behind the mirror. This is all projective. It's our mind projecting these images out. Normally, they project out to the correct place, which is why we're able to move around without bumping into things. This is not a new theory of vision. It's the theory that Plato and Euclid had. It's the theory believed in by traditional people all over the world, taught by Buddhist and Hindu philosophers. And it's also the theory believed by European children up to the age of 10 or 11. The developmental psychologist Jean Piaget found that European children believe that vision involves an outward projection of images. That's why Superman comics show rays coming out of his eyes. But he said by the age of 10 or 11, the average European child learns the correct view, which is that thoughts and images are invisible things located inside the head. We've all been brought up to believe that. We take it on trust when we're 10 or 11. All these grown-ups must know what they're talking about. But no one's ever seen a thought or an image inside a head. It's an astonishing hallucination, I think, that our entire civilization's been under for a long time now, that it's all inside the head. It goes against our most immediate experience. But of course, to question this is highly controversial. And I myself am a scientist, not a philosopher, so I'm interested in looking for evidence. If my mind reaches out to touch what I'm looking at, perhaps I can affect something just by looking at it. If I look at you from behind and you don't know I'm there, Perhaps I can affect you by looking at you. Could you feel when you're being looked at by somebody behind you? Now, as soon as you ask that, you see this is a common experience. Surveys show that more than 90% of the population have had that experience. You feel you're being looked at, you turn around and there's someone staring at you. Or you stare at someone and they turn around. There's a slight sex difference. More men than women have made people turn around by staring at them, and more women than men have experienced being stared at. But the majority of both sexes, and I'm sure the majority of people in this room, have had this experience themselves. Until 1985, there was virtually no scientific investigation of this subject. There were 4 published papers in the previous 100 years, because it's completely taboo. Even though it's such a common experience, it was simply not allowed to be discussed within science, totally taboo, because it ought not to happen. So the materialists say it's just a coincidence, you just forget all the times you turn around and there's no one looking at you, it's just selective memory and coincidence, there's nothing to it, it's superstition. But now research has been done on this now for the last 20 years, and it turns out that in simple tests, people really can tell when they're being looked at from behind. Not every time, but very significantly above chance. A simple version of this experiment has been running in the Amsterdam Science Museum, the NEMO Center, for the last 20 years. And the results, it's one of the biggest experiments ever conducted. The results are overwhelmingly significant statistically. The most sensitive subjects are children under the age of 9. It's interesting that children are particularly sensitive to this. It even seems to work through closed-circuit television. Many experiments have now shown that people are physiologically affected, their skin resistance changes, when they're being watched by someone in another room on a closed-circuit television screen, even though they don't know they're being watched. It's an unconscious physiological response. It turns out that animals are also sensitive to being looked at. Many animals can tell when they're looked at by people, and people can tell when they're looked at by animals. And probably animals can tell when they're looked at by other animals. I think this ability probably evolved a very long time ago in the context of predator-prey relationships. Any prey animal that could tell when a predator was watching it would escape better than one that couldn't tell. So I think natural selection would have favored this ability, and I think it's probably very widespread in the animal kingdom. We have this ability not because it's supernatural or paranormal. We have it because it's natural and normal, and it's something we share with many, many other animal species. I think all animals with image-forming eyes are projecting out a visual world. The world we're in is full of invisible perceptual projections from countless animals, just as it's full of invisible radio and television and mobile phone transmissions. So I think our minds are extended far beyond our bodies in every act of perception. If we look at a star, I think our minds stretch out over literally astronomical distances to touch that star. Our minds can stretch out right into the universe. And now, through telescopes, we've discovered galaxies beyond our own. Modern astronomy has opened up a vast new vision of the cosmos. I think our minds are now stretching out into vast regions of space that were not even imagined by people until the 20th century, of which no one was aware. But our minds are now filling the cosmos. Well, I've only had time this morning to discuss 2 of the dogmas. Three of them, that nature's mechanical, that matter's unconscious, and that our minds are confined to the insides of our brains. And as you see, when you turn these dogmas into questions, is nature mechanical? Is matter unconscious? Are our minds confined to the insides of our brains? Then when you turn them into questions, the evidence doesn't support these dogmas. In fact, it opens up a whole new set of questions, new sets of possibilities, new kinds of science become possible. The same is true of all the other dogmas on which materialism is based. And I'm going to come back this afternoon to discuss some of the others. But that's enough for now. Thank you.